Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I want to start today with a question that sounds simple, but it might actually ruin your day if you think about it too hard.
Oh boy, that's quite a promise.
Yeah, well, think about it. When you look at the world around you, like this room, your phone, your career, your relationships, do you see a collection of fixed things? Or do you see a continuous moving process?
I mean, that really does sound like a dormant philosophy major's pickup line, doesn't it?
It totally does. But it's actually the difference between looking at a photograph and watching a movie. And today we are diving into a worldview that claims we have spent the last 2,000 years obsessed with the photograph,
Right.
with things that are static and frozen, when we really should have been watching the movie all along.
We are. We're digging into a lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes, and we're analyzing the work of arguably the most influential American philosopher, John Dewey. Specifically, we're looking at his seminal book, Reconstruction in Philosophy.
And before you tune out, because you heard the word philosophy and assumed this is going to be about, guys in togas debating the definition of a chair, Dewey is different.
Very different.
Holmes presents Dewey as the guy who wanted to drag philosophy out of the ivory tower and put it to work right in the mud.
That is the core mission here. I mean, Dewey looked at the history of thought and essentially said, we've been asking the wrong questions. The old philosophy, as he called it, was obsessed with certainty.
It wanted eternal truths.
Exactly. It wanted to find the perfect answer that you could just put on a shelf and admire forever. But Dewey, he didn't care about the perfect answer. He cared about the answer that works right now.
So it's kind of the difference between a trophy and a hammer.
In a sense, yeah. One is for display. It implies you've already won the knowledge game. The other is a tool for building something new.
So the tension Dr. Holmes sets up for us is between this old philosophy, the trophy hunters, let's say, and Dewey's reconstruction, which are the tool builders. But to really understand why this matters to you and me, we have to look at how we view human nature itself. Because Holmes points out that if you stick with the classics, think Aristotle or the medieval scholastics, you view a human being as a substance.
Right. In classical metaphysics, a substance is a noun. It's a fixed entity. You have a soul, an essence, a core you that is unchanging, regardless of what happens around you.
You are the statue in the museum. The dust might settle on you, but the marble itself doesn't change.
But Dewey looks at biology, he looks at the emerging psychology of his time, and he says, no, that's just not how life
He
works.
says you aren't a noun, you're a verb.
Exactly. You aren't a fixed substance. You are a process of experience. You're a history of interactions. That's a pretty radical shift because it suggests that you don't actually stop at your skin.
And meaning what exactly?
Meaning you are defined by how you engage with the world.
This leads to my absolute favorite insight from the first part of the lecture. It completely flips the script on how we think about thinking.
Oh, the spectator theory.
Yeah, because the old philosophy treats us like we are floating brains, right?
Right.
Like our primary job is to sit around, look at the stars, and contemplate high-minded logical truths.
Right, this is often called the spectator theory of knowledge. The idea is that the mind is just a mirror reflecting nature passively.
Exactly. We're just watching the world. But Dewey says, hold on. Look at the biology. We aren't creatures of intellect first. We are creatures of desire.
That's the biological grounding. If you think about it in evolutionary terms, why did we develop a brain? Not to do Sudoku or argue about metaphysics, we developed a brain because we were hungry or cold or in danger. Dewey argues that thought is a biological function. It is something an organism does to solve a problem.
So thinking isn't this lofty spiritual activity that separates us from the animals. It's functional. It's like digestion or breathing. It's a survival mechanic.
He calls it functionalist psychology. We think because there is a snag in our experience, everything is going along smoothly. That's habit. And then suddenly something goes wrong.
We get hungry.
Or the car breaks down. Or we lose a job. That is when thinking actually starts. Thinking is the tool we use to smooth out the snag and get back to the flow of living.
This redefines experience entirely. Holmes spends some time contrasting Dewey with the British empiricists, guys like John Locke. And I remember learning about Locke in school, the blank slate, right? We are just passive buckets waiting for the world to drop ideas into us.
Yes, for Locke and the traditional empiricists, experience was strictly internal. It was a mental snapshot. You see a red apple, and your brain takes a little picture of redness and roundness and files away in the cabinet. It's very passive. You're just receiving data.
But for Dewey, experience is a contact sport.
It's an interaction. It is the organism pushing against the environment and the environment pushing back. It's not what happens in your head. It's what happens between you and the world. It involves risk, adjustment, and change.
Which brings us to why Dewey hated the old philosophy so much. Holmes quotes Dewey using this incredibly evocative phrase. He says the classical tradition attempts to keep a freeze-dried past.
It's such a powerful critique.
It really paints a clear picture. We found something that worked once, like a social structure, a religious dogma, a moral rule, and we freeze-dried it. We turned it into a rigid doctrine so it would never spoil. But why do we do that? Why are we so obsessed with keeping things exactly as they were?
Fear. Holmes emphasizes that the search for absolute certainty is almost always driven by a fear of the unknown. The world is chaotic and scary. If we can claim we found the eternal truth, we feel safe. We feel like we have a fortress.
But Dewey says that's a trap.
By freeze-drying the past, you make yourself unable to deal with the future.
You're essentially bringing a map of ancient Rome to navigate modern New York.
And you're wondering why you keep getting hit by taxis. Dewey wants to move us from a philosophy of static positions to a philosophical attitude, a readiness to adapt. And Holmes pinpoints the historical pivot where this change began. It starts with Francis Bacon.
Francis Bacon. Now, we usually associate him with the scientific method.
Correct. But specifically, look at what he said the goal of knowledge is. Before Bacon, the goal was contemplation. You look at the stars to appreciate their divine perfection. You don't touch. You just look. You admire the essence of things. Bacon flips the table. He says, knowledge is power.
Nature to be commanded must be obeyed.
Exactly. He wanted to understand how nature worked so he could control it. He wanted to cure disease, build bridges, improve life. Dewey looks at Bacon and says, yes, but we need to go further. Bacon applied that logic to physical nature. Dewey wants to apply it to society.
That's a massive leap. It's one thing to engineer a bridge. It's another to engineer a community.
It is. And to be clear, we aren't endorsing this view of social engineering. We're just unpacking the source material here. But look at the context. Holmes reminds us that Dewey is writing Reconstruction and Philosophy between World War I and World War II.
The world is literally on fire.
You have the Great Depression, the rise of fascism, the failure of the League of Nations, the old philosophy, the contemplation of eternal truths, the reliance on dusty traditions, didn't stop the trenches of World War I. It didn't stop the economic collapse.
Right.
Dewey is looking at a Europe that tore itself apart and saying, clearly, staring at the concept of justice didn't help us actually be just.
So politics, for Dewey, stops being about abstract theory. It becomes the science of conflict resolution.
It becomes problem solving. We have a specific mess. How do we fix it? Not what is the perfect state, but how do we stop this specific war? Or how do we feed these specific people?
To have that mindset, though, you have to believe that the future isn't already written. You have to believe in what Holmes calls the open world.
This is the massive Darwinian influence on Dewey. Before Darwin, we lived in a closed world. Species were fixed. Natural law was set in stone. You had a destiny. You were an acorn and you were destined to become an oak tree. You couldn't decide to become a palm tree.
But Darwin blows the roof off the greenhouse.
He shows that forms change. Species aren't fixed. And if biology isn't fixed, then neither is destiny. We live in an open universe.
And if the universe is open,
then anything is possible. There are no fixed ends we are guaranteed to reach. Holmes actually draws a comparison here to Jean-Paul Sartre and existentialism. If there are no values written in the stars, we are condemned to be free. We have to create the values ourselves.
This is where Holmes brings in a literary reference that I thought was just perfect for explaining the wrong way to live. He talks about Mr. Micawber from Charles Dickens's David Copperfield.
Yes, the eternal optimist who is always waiting for something to turn up.
I think we all know a Mr. Micawber. They just stand there, assuming the universe will eventually sort itself out in their favor. Oh, the job will come. The luck will change.
And Dewey says, don't be Micawber. Since we are organisms in an environment, we shouldn't just wait for the world to impress itself upon us. We have to structure our surroundings. We have to be active.
This changes education too, doesn't it? Because if we aren't trying to absorb static truths, why are we making kids memorize facts?
Exactly. If the world is always changing, the facts you memorize today might be useless tomorrow. Dewey argues that education shouldn't be about the transmission of doctrine. It should be about fostering practical intelligence.
Learning to learn.
We should be teaching people how to solve problems, how to inquire, how to adapt.
So we've got this practical intelligence. We are active. We are solving problems. We aren't waiting for Micawber's luck. But I have to play devil's advocate here. If we throw out all the eternal truths and we throw out the freeze-dried past, what is the truth? What are we actually aiming at?
This is definitely the most controversial part of Dewey's philosophy. He proposes a pragmatic theory of truth.
Is this the cash value concept?
Borrowed from William James, yes. In the old philosophy, truth was a mirror. If my idea perfectly reflected reality, it was true. Dewey says, forget the mirror. Truth is workability.
Workability.
An idea is true if it pays off, if it satisfies the desire that prompted the thought, if it solves the problem.
So an idea isn't a picture of the world. It's a tool. It's a hammer. You don't ask if a hammer is true. You ask if it drives the nail.
Holmes calls it a hypothesis. In Dewey's system, every idea you have is simply a plan of action. You have a problem, you form a hypothesis, an idea of how to solve it. If you act on it and it works, it is true.
Holmes uses a great analogy to explain this instrumentalism. He talks about a road and a highwayman, a thief.
It's a really crucial distinction for understanding this.
So imagine a road. How do you measure if it's a good road? You don't ask about the moral character of the people on it. You ask, does it provide effective transportation? If a highwayman uses the road to go rob a village, the road is still working as a road.
Right. The road is an instrument.
And Holmes says Dewey views ideas the same way. You don't judge an idea by whether it fits some abstract moral category immediately. You ask, does it function to reorganize experience? Does it get you from point A to point B?
That's the instrumental view. Ideas are tools to bridge gaps in our experience.
But wait, if truth is just what works, and we are talking about highwaymen, doesn't this get ethically messy? I mean, if it works for the thief to rob me, if his hypothesis, get money, is satisfied by stick a gun in the host's face, is that true for him?
You've hit on the big criticism. Holmes addresses this by comparing Dewey to utilitarianism. You know, the greatest good for the greatest number. Dewey sounds a lot like a utilitarian.
But he rejects the label.
He does. And this is fascinating. He rejects it because utilitarians look to the past. They look at what made people happy before, calculate an average, and make a general rule. Dewey looks to the future.
How does that solve the highwayman problem?
Dewey would say you can't just look at the thief's immediate satisfaction. You have to look at the total consequences in the future. Does robbing people actually resolve the conflict in the long run? Or does it create more conflict, police chases, prison time, and social instability?
So it's not just does it work right this second, but does it work for the growth of experience continuously?
Exactly. But here is the catch. Dewey insists that every situation is unique. You can't just blindly apply a cookie-cutter rule from the past, like thou shalt not steal. You have to look at this specific situation. There is no highest good that stays the same forever. Every situation has its own unique good that needs to be discovered.
It's like situational ethics on steroids. It requires so much brain power. You can't just follow the manual. You have to write a new page of the manual for every problem you face.
It is demanding. It demands that we be responsive to the now, rather than obedient to the past.
And this practical mindset even changes how Dewey handles the heavy theological stuff. Holmes talks about the problem of evil, the classic stumper. If God is all good and all powerful, why is there evil?
I love Dewey's take on this because it's so dismissive of the intellectual game. And again, we're just reporting Dewey's stance here, not taking a theological position. But Dewey says that the logical problem, trying to reconcile God and evil conceptually, is irrelevant.
Irrelevant. That's a bold thing to say to theologians.
He says it's pragmatically meaningless. It has no cash value. Sitting around debating how God could allow a disease doesn't cure the disease. For Dewey, the only real problem of evil is the practical one. What are we going to do about the evil that exists right now?
Stop asking why and start asking how do we fix it.
It shifts the burden from theology to action. Don't rationalize evil. Eliminate it. It's a refusal to get bogged down in questions that don't have actionable answers.
We've covered a lot of ground here. We've moved from substance to process, from a frozen past to an open future, from truth as a mirror to truth as a tool. Holmes wraps up the lecture by connecting Dewey to some modern thinkers who carried this torch. He mentions W.V.O. Quine.
Quine is essential to understanding where this philosophy leads. He develops this concept called the web of belief.
I like the visual of a spider web.
It's very appropriate. Quine argues that our beliefs aren't these isolated building blocks. You know, you don't have a separate brick for the sky is blue and another brick for murder is wrong. They're all woven together. If you touch one part of the web, the whole thing shakes.
Holmes gives a great example of this with the phrase, God is good.
He does. And this connects right back to pragmatism. He says, look at that sentence. God is good. In one context, like a systematic theology class, That is an analytic statement. It's a definition. God is good by definition.
Like saying a triangle has three sides. It's true because we said it is.
Right. But take that same sentence to a funeral. You are comforting a grieving friend. You say, God is good. In that context, it's not a definition. It's a tool. It is an instrumental statement used to provide comfort and stability in a time of crisis. The meaning of the belief depends entirely on its function in the web of experience at that exact moment.
That is so pragmatic. It's not about what the sentence is eternally. It's about what the sentence does right now.
And that leads to the final figure Holmes mentions, Richard Rorty. Rorty takes Dewey's reconstruction to its logical, perhaps extreme, conclusion. He wrote Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature.
And he's the one who says we should just give up on finding the truth with a capital T.
Essentially. Rorty argues that since we can't have a mirror in our minds that perfectly reflects reality, since we can never be absolutely certain philosophy should stop trying to prove things, we should stop acting like we can get to the bottom of the universe.
If we stop trying to get to the bottom of it, what's left?
Conversation. Rorty says we should settle for interesting conversation. We keep the dialogue going. We keep trying new descriptions of the world, new vocabularies to see if they work better. But we give up the pretense that we've found the final answer.
That is liberating, but also kind of terrifying. It sounds like we're just floating.
It is the ultimate expression of the open world. There is no anchor. There's only the swimming.
So to recap the journey Dr. Holmes took us on today, we started with the old philosophy. It was safe. It was static. It viewed us as fixed substances and the world as a place of eternal truths.
Then Dewey comes along and says, look at the biology. We are creatures of desire, processes of experience, constantly interacting with a changing environment.
And because the world is open and evolving, thanks to Darwin, our truth must be practical. It's not a copy of reality. It's a tool to navigate it. We don't wait for Mr. McCauver's luck. We build the road.
And we don't get bogged down in unanswerable questions like, why is there evil? We just get to work fixing it. It is a philosophy of action, of reconstruction.
It really makes you look at your own beliefs differently. It forces you to ask, are my beliefs dusty trophies on a shelf that I'm defending because I'm scared? Or are they tools in a toolbox that I'm using to build something?
And that raises the final, perhaps most provocative question for you to consider.
What's that?
If Dewey is right, and we live in a universe without fixed ends, where anything is possible and truth is just what works right now, does that liberate us to create a better future? Or does it leave us without a compass? Meaning, if truth is only what works, what happens when what works for me conflicts directly with what works for you? In the absence of a fixed standard, in the absence of an eternal truth, how do we decide whose truth wins? Is it just power? Or can we truly reconstruct a society based purely on pragmatic problem solving?
That is a deep dive for another day. Thanks for listening, everyone.